Hello, this is Kazimir Karza, and there is something I think that needs to be discussed in regards to the concept of pristine nature or pristine wilderness. So I have actually spoken about this before, but not really at sufficient length. It was just one very, very short clip. I was walking through the woods and I saw some mistletoes growing on trees because the trees were bare. It was in the middle of winter. And I started just thinking about the relationship between the mistletoe and the tree, and consequentially, you know, other relationships that one might consider parasitic, or pretty much all the relationships in the wild, because beings generally tend to subsist off of each other. There's the whole food chain thing that is in reality not nearly as simple as just a chain. It is more like a very deeply interconnected and complex web. If you really tried to create like a map of who eats who and who eats who when, it would get pretty crazy. But I thought I needed to additionally clarify certain things, because radical environmentalists such as myself often get accused of being misanthropic or having some sort of contempt for either humanity in general, or sometimes even specifically for indigenous communities around the globe, because they subsist off the land. And certain people have been saying, including I think Slavoj Žižek, you know, they said that it is ridiculous for us to have some sort of concept of pristine wilderness where it is untouched wilderness, when pretty much everywhere that humans have been present, they have made some sort of impact on their environment, which of course is true. But as I will explain later on, it is not just about making some sort of impact on the environment. It is what kind of consequences does the impact that you have really produce in the end. But just before we get into that, I would like to clarify that it's mostly not truly radical environmentalists who are the ones trying to bar like indigenous people from hunting on their land or whatever. Usually these are more mainstream environmental groups who really follow an ideology of separating people from wilderness completely, like cutting them off, saying, yeah, you know, people will destroy it, so let's just keep them away. But also these very same groups will often look the other way as, you know, people go and start trophy hunting or whatever. And it's just really disgusting when there are indigenous populations who are forced to abandon their ways of life that they've been living for a very long time and even assimilate into society because they can just no longer subsist legally, while the government permits hunting tourists, you know, all these rich, vile douchebags, so they can go and shoot a lion and then take pictures of themselves and post them on Facebook. And I'll justify this by saying, oh, you need to develop these countries, they need to have an income or something. And I wish to for humanity to stop certain very destructive practices and return to the wilderness. And this is where I need to explain my concept of pristine wilderness with humans, of course. You know, I don't view humans as some sort of separate force in the world. What I am talking about is how certain cultures can sustainably live in a certain environment without depleting its resources or being a very destructive influence that gradually transforms a certain part of the world in such a way that it makes it impossible to continue the same way of lifestyle for a very, very long time. These more mainstream environmentalists often talk about indigenous people with a sort of performative respect, where they say, yes, these people are so wonderful, they live in touch with their nature. When they say this, they often don't display any sort of real understanding what makes these communities actually live in harmony with their surroundings. They often think it comes down to some sort of spiritual thing where, like, I don't know, an indigenous person will go up to a tree and ask the tree spirits to leave or whatever before chopping it down, while the Westerner simply chops down the tree. But it's not really about that. Even if some weirdo made every single logger go up to every single tree before it is chopped down and say, please spirits, leave this body or whatever, it wouldn't change in any meaningful way the ecological impact of doing a clear cut. And if we talk about, let's say, indigenous spiritualities, of course, I'm doing a massive, massive generalization here. There's literally thousands of such cultures globally on every continent, pretty much, except, I guess, Antarctica. It's not just about being spiritual. It is more so about understanding your surroundings and understanding all of the other organisms in your area as living beings who form a very complex net in which you and everybody you know depend for survival. It's about seeing your surroundings not as some sort of dead resource that is there just to serve your immediate desires. It's about acknowledging the reciprocity inherent in wild nature and participating in it actively. As I previously mentioned in that video where I saw mistletoes and I started talking about them, this is one of the examples of how in the wilderness things always cycle around. So I mentioned how mistletoe is a parasite on the tree, but it generally tends to make sure that it doesn't take too much from the tree or this tree starts dying. And then also when mistletoe drops its leaves, which it never dries up, they are much more full of nutrients than the dead leaves of trees. So the tree and the surrounding soil benefit from these big nutrient bombs that mistletoes drop down, and even the tree sort of regains some of its stuff back. And it's a relationship where, for example, I'm sure the trees don't enjoy having mistletoes on them, but their presence is not a death sentence by any means. They can coexist. Then there's further benefits. For example, mistletoe produces these little white berries that are very sticky, and then birds come and they eat mistletoe berries, and then they poop down because birds have very fast digestive systems, and they also enrich the soil beneath these trees that are infested with mistletoes. And there's another interesting case that involves humans, but not us in the role of the parasite. It actually involves, there's like an intestinal parasite, and I really remember this very vaguely, and I don't remember where I read this. It's been a while. But there is a human intestinal parasite that tends to produce some sort of substance that, when present in the body, reduces the possibility of certain autoimmune diseases. So here's another example of, you know, the parasite lives, but even if it takes some of our food, it is by far not the end of the world. Or, you know, speaking of diseases, most viruses, for example, when there was the COVID pandemic, pretty sure everybody noticed how it gradually mutated towards being increasingly less harmful to the body of the host, because the interest of the virus or any other parasite of that sort is not to kill its host, is actually to use the host to reproduce and then spread. And if you kill your host, that becomes much harder. Or another interesting example is, if you've ever been to the mountains where cows are grazing outside, you will see these cows, they walk on grass, they eat it constantly. And if you are a grass, a plant, I'm sure it's not very great to be constantly chewed on by a cow. But in exchange for eating the grass, cows then poop all over the place, and this poop enriches the soil and helps grass grow more. Or when predators like wolves kill old and sickly deer and other larger herbivorous mammals, even though that individual does certainly not benefit from being eaten, and even though it might be very emotionally distressing for the other members of the deer herd, this actually ends up preventing rapid spread of diseases or any such nuisances that might actually damage the entire population. So beings who live in a certain area always impact one another in certain ways. Many of these ways are often not very pleasant. So I hope that now you have been able to sort of understand what a wild relationship is all about. It's about reciprocity, it's about continuous cycling of substances that enable life. And this is what makes certain cultures who live in a way that helps to maintain this never-ending cycling very good and better than cultures who do seemingly everything in their power to destroy the cycle of life, and with it life itself as like a grander concept. And this is the problem of civilization. Now, civilization does a couple of things. So, for example, one of the key characteristics of civilization are cities. And cities are pretty much areas that have been so thoroughly depleted of any resources useful to its inhabitants that they require importation of resources. And if we want to import resources to an area that has been rendered, whatever the opposite of self-sufficient is, you're now putting a much larger strain on these pieces of land where there is farming going on. Agriculture is another key characteristic of civilization. And because agricultural practices aim to maximize the output, often to just export it into a city, which is essentially some sort of dead zone. Not completely, of course. There's bugs living in cities, there's tiny little plants looking through the cracks of concrete and so on. But if you look, for example, at a level of biotic diversity in some relatively untouched forest versus the biotic diversity of a city, you will quickly find out that the city is itself an environmental catastrophe. So in order to maximize the soil output of growing, for example, certain plants or growing cattle or whatever, you have to remove pretty much every other species from that area, and this tends to ruin the soil, which has been a big problem historically. For example, in the Middle East, there used to be lush, big-treed forests, and now they are pretty much gone. Both plowing that exposes microbes in the earth to the sun and kills them, and irrigation that tends to poison the earth with salts have contributed greatly to the Middle East's destruction. But modern industrial agriculture is even so much worse. There is a lot of data you can find on this, but it pretty much requires very concentrated chemical fertilizers to even grow anything in many fields. Topsoil has been completely ruined. It's basically sand. And don't get me even started on these modern practices of using pesticides and everything. There is no end to the idiocy. But even when there are things that could potentially at least return to the cycle of life from civilization, like for example excrement or food waste and all these other things, that is often impossible just because of the sheer quantity of them. If I or you or your family or some random animal goes into the forest and poops in one place, this benefits the soil. But now when you have very large numbers, you know, sometimes hundreds, thousands of animals in one place, and their waste accumulates, it stops being beneficial, but it starts being very toxic, actually. I know that somewhere in America there is an entire lake of pig poo, and if you just poured that onto the soil, you would pretty much kill everything. Human waste or pig waste or anybody else's waste, biological of course, you know, I'm not talking about plastic bottles, has historically always, up until now, benefited ecosystems. In America, you have this phenomenon of salmon-dependent forests, where salmon bring the nutrients back from the ocean into the rivers when they, you know, return to mate and die. And in the process, they first feed the grizzly bears, who tend to only eat their heads because they contain the brain and they're sweet. And then the dead bodies of salmon get flushed on the shores of rivers, or when the rivers overflow, they go deeper into the woods, and then they get decomposed there, feed the trees and other plant life. And I know I've heard this, they have even found molecules from salmon in mountain goats in certain areas, so you know how far this can actually travel. But now we have nuclear waste, we have plastic waste that won't decompose for God knows how long, and it's really harmful for organisms. There's articles coming out all the time about the health detriments of the presence existence of microplastics, and even the stuff that we could potentially return is utterly ruined. And another problem is that diets in civilization tend to be low in nutrients but high in calories, which tends to enable quicker reproduction of humans, and with a constantly growing population, the demands for both space and demands on the soil to produce more food grow worse and worse and worse, and so you eventually have to go out into the world and acquire more and more land, and this is how the first empires actually came to be. But of course, when you live on a finite planet in a world that isn't just some sort of infinite plane that stretches forever in every direction, you're going to eventually deplete every available resource, and when that happens, it is not gonna be fun. And that just makes civilization a type of culture that is fundamentally unsustainable, and therefore purely on the level of, you know, if we want life to continue on this planet, undesirable, something to get rid of. Because the alternative is mass death. We're already in the Anthropocene, so-called. It should probably be called something like a civilized scene, more appropriately, when certain cultures have caused a die-off so terrible that it is compared to that one event where a meteor crashed on Earth and killed all the dinosaurs. And so, to return to the original topic, a pristine wilderness or pristine nature can include humans and has historically included humans for 2 million years, or perhaps more, you know, it really depends on when you start counting our genus as being human. Taxonomy is kind of arbitrary sometimes. And it is not anti-human to say that civilization needs to go, because civilization and humans are not the same thing, not by a long shot. It is in fact anti-human and also anti-life to say that civilization is something to be saved or maintained in the future, because it is fundamentally unsustainable and threatens the very existence of life. And people who think that humans don't belong in the wilderness, they see this as some sort of a dichotomy, you know, the human world and the natural world. Those people, I'd say, have very little understanding of these processes and usually see wilderness just as some sort of abstract, aesthetic ideal, not as the real physical world that anything that is on this planet is inevitably interconnected with and has a relationship with it, whether somebody likes it or not. No amount of segregation and locking ourselves into bubbles will save the planet. The only thing that can do that is stopping and dealing away with civilization.